we're into the last hour of the 9 till noon show, and I'm joined now by Kenneth Conlon from the Donegal Weather Channel. Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning, Michaela.
So, Kenneth, I'm looking out, the sun is shining. Can we look forward to much more of this?
Yeah, so over the next coming days and into the weekend, it's actually an improving trend. Over the next 2 days, especially up around Donegal, it's going to be quite, well, I wouldn't say it's going to be hot, but it's going to be warm. It's going to be temperatures in the mid-20s. I'm sure a lot of people would take that with some beautiful sunshine. Then Thursday will be a bit cooler. You're looking maybe temperatures in the high teens and the low 20s, and there'll be a few showers around as well, maybe possibly odd isolated thunderstorm in places. But from Friday, then Saturday, Sunday and into Monday, it's looking like an improvement trend again with high pressure strengthening up across Ireland. And generally when you get the central area of the high pressure sitting across the country, you're going to get a lot of sunshine with that as well. So with the weekend, we're looking again temperatures in around the mid-20s, maybe 25, 26, maybe reaching 27 degrees in parts of Donegal.
Lovely. And thinking back to last year, I know we have had a few dull days this year, but you know, generally the weather has been warmer this year.
The weather, yeah, it has been a warmer year. I think it's been a lot drier too this year. There's been, I suppose, a long period. I suppose around, I think it was March, April, and then into the end of May, we had like a few weeks there where we virtually had no rain. And then you seem to get these kind of unsettled periods, and then you get the high pressure strengthening again. So you do, but I suppose over the next coming days, rainfall levels will be below normal again. Again, there could be a risk, I suppose, near the end of the weekend, maybe early next week, when this warmer weather starts to break down again. There could be a few isolated thunderstorms up across Donegal, but that could be, you could be looking at Tuesday, Wednesday next week. But come as this develops over the next coming days, this weather might even prolong into the middle of next week, but that kind of detail won't be known as we head into the weekend.
Well, we'll be hoping and praying for that. Kenneth, thanks so much for joining us and giving us that update this morning. I'm now joined by Sandra Smith, a relationship and parenting trauma therapist. Good morning, Sandra.
Morning, Michaela. How are you?
I'm good. So we're talking today about how does step-parenting coaching work. So I suppose, what is step-parenting coaching first off, Sandra?
Well, it's, what is it? So in one, it's really supporting the parent who is struggling with coming into a new dynamic, which they are unfamiliar with, first of all. You see, there's so much more to it, Michaela. This is really the surface, what I'm sharing now, right? And to maybe start off is, first of all, is to acknowledge how difficult it is to be a step parent. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a step parent, but I have 6 children myself, so I know very much how difficult parenting can be in general, never mind step parenting. Mm-hmm. But I was a child raised by step parents, and that's why I very much understand the dynamic and what might be going on, and maybe also why I dive a bit deeper into that kind of, let's say, challenge, mm-hmm. because I know personally how much damage it can do for the child or the teen or sometimes adults, you know, because when the relationship develops, very often if it survives, those children do become adults and it comes with its own challenges then again. So the dynamics keeps changing. But yeah, it's, for me, it's the people that come to me is really people that are struggling of how do I enter this dynamic? How is the relationship with my partner? How can our relationship survive this? And then also, how can I be there for, depending on the age of the children, but how can I approach this with consciousness, mm-hmm. without me losing myself, if that makes any sense, Michaela. Yeah.
And I suppose we're speaking about this as well as Catherine Sporzinger, you know, has talked about, you know, hiring a coach like yourself before becoming a stepmom to Chris Pratt's children. And is this something that, you know, we think of these people that have celebrity status, they have access to all this. Is this something that, you know, people here in Ireland do benefit from as well?
Oh my goodness, 100%, because you see, is it because it's a celebrity that people take more notice? Mm-hmm. And do we feel that, okay, Can we do this ourselves? I think in general, it's about the awareness, Michaela. And I think if you have the awareness and if you're okay to ask for support and help, I think that's your first step. Because very often the step parenting can be so messy. And very often we don't speak about it. We carry this by ourselves and for different reasons, right? Because there's this idea that if you love each other enough, the rest will just fall into place. And that a solid couple means a solid family. But in real life, as we just really said, it doesn't work like that, right? Nothing comes with a magic wand, especially not with blended families, because depending on the age, you can be that threat for the child.
Yeah.
Maybe the dream of mommy and daddy getting back together is now out the window and you become that bad person and they start resenting you. And you see, there's so much more to it. But what the message I really would love to get out there is it's about the connection. The connection doesn't happen on a schedule. Connection has to grow very slowly and it needs space. And very, very often it will need support. Mm-hmm. And I know we speak about step-parent here, but we need support in general, even with our own children in parenting. And it's really normalizing this. It's okay to reach out to somebody that can support you, to sit with you, to guide you through it, or whatever is coming up for you.
And every scenario is so different as well. So that's why, you know, reaching out to the likes of yourself, you know, that you can help, you know, it might be with the children, say, or, you know, the person that's not the biological parent coming into this new relationship. It is very daunting for all involved.
Very much so, because you see, sometimes we forget we have this relationship with the parent, then there's the relationship with the children that needs to be worked on, and that connection has to be built over time. But we also enter then very often a co-parenting dynamic, because if the other parent is still out there, and let's say I'm in this relationship with my husband and he already has children, the mom from the children will also be there. So now you're entering a whole different level again, which is the co-parenting. So there's so much happening and it can be so daunting. It can be a very lonely place, you know, and I hear it so often. I don't know where I fit in. I feel invisible, or I'm afraid to speak up. What if I make things worse?
Yeah.
And that's then, so what can we do when we're stepping into a family dynamic that's already formed, you know? And that's where the process begins then, let's say when they come to me or they seek support from somebody else.
And what kind of challenges would you see, say, children facing in relation to this?
Oh, So the children, and I can speak from my own experience. You see, again, we're entering very shallow water here, because the parent could come in with, let's say we call it she can come in with her children, her partner has children. So if all these children will come together, then like in my upbringing, my father went on to have three more children with my stepmom. So now you become really the outsider if the step parent is not conscious about their own challenges and come in with no awareness, no consciousness. That's where the damage is being done. And it's very much, there's no connection there. In my case, there was absolutely no connection there. There is that fear of, okay, she doesn't like me. She doesn't want me. And we know the damage you can do under seven. It can be huge, because children do not understand your perspective. They work more on energy and vibe. Words mean very little. So it's all about the energy and how you show up for that person. So it can be very challenging. It can be anything you can imagine. The fear, if there was a slight bit of hope that mom and dad might have come together, like I said earlier, now this person comes in and is taking all that away.
Yeah.
So then they start resenting you, because again, they do not understand. They start maybe working against you rather than with you, you know. And again, it's like having teenagers, it's creating, and I can't stress it enough, it's creating that attunement, connection, and awareness of how can I embrace this child or children that where there's psychological safety, that it's okay for them to have the emotions that come with the separation of mom and dad. But how can I hold that and not, again, lose myself in that? And that is the main process from my perspective when I work with step parents, is really to turn the mirror and not go in, okay, I need to fix this, I need to do this, I have to and I should, but actually see, well, what's happening for me when I enter this dynamic?
Yeah.
What's going on for me? And where can I seek that support to create that psychological safety? And it's not going to happen overnight, right? Again, it takes time. It takes a long time to build that connection.
And I suppose it's something, you know, there are so many blended families now, but it's something that's not really talked about either. The help that is needed.
Yeah.
Do you think there's still some kind of stigma around that? Is that why people aren't?
Oh, yes. And is it the shame? Is it the guilt of what if I mess it up? What if it doesn't work out? Where is it going to leave us? You know, and especially small villages, everybody knows one another, or sometimes they think they know one another. Yeah. And it's very much, like you said, that stigma then. I rather say nothing and suffer in silence. And I see it here very often in my own practice. I work internationally via Zoom, but I also see people face to face. And it's when, before I started my private practice, I did a bit of a research, what people liked, what they felt comfortable with. And I can comfortably say that 9 out of 10 people did not want to be seen going into Sandra because people will make stories up.
Yeah.
You see, so there's still a huge stigma on seeking support, regardless if it's parenting or co-parenting or step-parenting, even if it's just for self-development. There's still a big stigma around that, for sure.
And do you find that it's more small measures that are needed to help people transition into this scenario?
Would you mind repeating that? Is it small?
Yeah. Do you feel that it's small measures that help people on this journey rather than, you know, a big shift?
Yeah, and you see, small or not small, it depends on the person because everybody's different. It also depends on what trauma people carry, on what parenting style people have. We call it, or I call it, that's where conscious parenting of self comes in, which is the practice of becoming the loving, regulated adult for yourself. So you can show up steady for others. And to clarify, this is not about being a perfect parent. It's again about the awareness. In short, it's building connection before correction and have that compassion for yourself because there's no perfect parent out there, just like there's no ideal child, right? So it's about regulating the nervous system. It's exploring what are my triggers? Why can't I say no? Why can't I have any boundaries? What's in my way? And it could be very small, but we always start with awareness. And understanding then, you see, if you understand the conscious parenting, if you turn that mirror instead of looking at the child, and you will more understand that if I turn the mirror to myself, and I can do that now with compassion, what was my upbringing? What's in my way? Because you see, and I'm trying quickly to think, how would I explain it to you to make it somewhat easy? It's all about those triggers, and it isn't about the other. It's always touching with something within me.
Mm-hmm.
So we always turn that mirror, and that could be depending. You see, Michaela, people that come here very often will say, fix my child, fix my husband, you know, but that's unfortunately, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
So we gently turn the mirror and see, well, what is going on for you? What's happening for you? What is the trigger for you? And now how can we explore that with an open mind, an open heart? And then, like you probably know, I work under the guidance of Dr. Gabor Maté. That's the compassionate inquiry. So we see what's under the belief that you carry. We explore the behavior, what's underneath the behavior, what's actually in the body. Mm-hmm. Because very often the mind will tell you a story, but we also know now that the body is telling the truth.
Yeah.
You see, and in a way, for some people, they're happy with a few tools. And then you have people, once they open up Pandora's box, there's no going back.
Yeah.
And very often people are very committed and determined to, okay, how do I want to show up in the relationship? If that's with a child, if that's with a partner, but also the relationship I have with myself, how can I become a bit more kinder to myself?
Yeah, because it is a huge journey for people.
Massive. It's a lifelong journey. That's why you cannot say, you cannot put a time on this. Like I said, sometimes you have people, they don't want to do the work, as we call it. And that's, everybody is entitled to that. So they might ask for a few tools. What can I do when I become triggered? What can I do if my child does this? But at the end of the day, it's about doing the deeper work on yourself. And I always say it, I did it. I started myself with Dr. Tony Humphries 10 years ago. It was the best gift I gave myself, mm-hmm. not only for me, but for all my relationship, and especially for my parenting, yeah. for my children, because I didn't, it helped me not to project my childhood onto yeah. my, or my beliefs or my values, you see.
Yeah. Sandra, thank you so much. That was an interesting insight, and I suppose it's something we don't often think about. So thank you so much. That is Sandra.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Michaela.
That is Sandra Smith, a relationship and parenting trauma therapist.
Highland Radio Time Checks, brought to you by Airgrid, the operator and developer of Ireland's electricity grid. Airgrid, powering up communities, powering up Ireland. The time is...
The time is 20 minutes past 11. I'm joined now by Pat Cronty, who is the CEO of the Vintners Federation of Ireland. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Michaela. How are you?
Good, thank you very much. So the stark figures are that a pub is shutting on average every 3.5 days across Ireland. And this has led to the Vintners Federation of Ireland calling on the government to cut excise levies on draft products in the upcoming budget. How dire is the situation, Pat?
It's very serious, Michaela, and in fact, it's even more serious than the figure suggests. The headline figure of one pub every 3.5 days is measured over the last 20 years. If you measure over only the last 5 years, mm-hmm. it's actually one pub every 2.8 days. So the situation is getting worse. It's not even just bad and staying the way it is. It's actually getting worse. So we do need intervention. We do need change, because if nothing changes, then the writing is going to be on the wall for quite a lot of people.
Yeah. And cutting the excise levies on draft products, what kind of impact would this have financially?
It would have a huge impact. If you... Government has asked us several times to try and come up with industry-specific or sector-specific responses or solutions, and this one is exactly that, because it doesn't help off-licences, it doesn't help supermarkets, it doesn't help people who are already making plenty of money. Mm-hmm. It helps the publican whose lifeblood is selling draft beer. The excise rebate is only being asked for on draft products, and that way... And it would be by way of a rebate, so that they already have to have traded. They can't be gone out of business or anything else. They have to be still trading. They have to be doing their best, and they will be supported. And the maximum a pub could achieve in the course of a year would be 20,000 of a support. But for most small pubs, they wouldn't see a fraction of that. But a fraction of that would be enough to help them.
Yeah. And do you?
And when you look at the total cost. Sorry, Michael, just the total cost, say, of the VAT proposed change, the total cost in a year there is 550 million. The total cost of what we're proposing would be 73 million, and it would help an awful lot more businesses.
Do you feel
so
that...
So it's not a matter of one or the other.
Yeah, do you feel that your industry is being left behind in all of this sometimes?
Well, I feel that there has been a kind of a feeling that they've given the 9% VAT, so that's it for the hospitality industry. That's them sorted and looked after. The VAT change only helps hospitality businesses who sell food. Mm-hmm. It does not help a pub that does not sell food. So it can't. There's nothing in it in that for them. But they have been hit with all the same costs. They have all the same labour cost changes and all the other costs that have helped to make business unsustainable over the last few years. So, but they're being left out of any help or any solution.
And is a low footfall contributing to this? You know, we do see pubs in certain areas, they're rammed and they become somewhat of a tourist attraction. But, you know, the smaller, local, more rural pubs, do you think that, you know, at-home drinking is still having a huge impact on that?
Yeah, look, all the different things that have changed over the years, and even in more recent years since COVID, all do have an effect. But the concern I have in representing 3,500 publicans is that we're now seeing publicans who actually are doing decent business. They may not be the ones that are rammed or the little one in the on the crossroads that is doing very little, but ones that are doing a healthy business, that are doing reasonable trade, providing decent employment and doing all those things, and they're not able to make a net profit.
Yeah.
Because the government-driven costs are just meaning there's nothing left. You're paying all your bills, you're paying all your costs, but there's nothing left at the end of the day.
And has the government given any indication that they will take your call on board?
No, they haven't. There's no one better than the two ministers in finance and public expenditure for keeping their cards close to their chest. Mm. But our job is to make sure that everyone that they talk to, all the line ministers, and particularly in enterprise, tourism and employment, and in rural affairs, and indeed all the TDs who come from those areas, to make sure that they know what we're talking about and that they can help us to make the case to those ministers, so that when they do get to the budget, they might help us, because they're going to have to make a decision at some stage in terms of look at the situation and say, do they want pubs to survive? Because
yeah.
Pubs aren't just another business. Pubs are social hubs, they're cultural hubs, they're community and tourism hubs. They're like in France, they're giving grants to the mayors of small towns where there's no pub left to go find someone to open a pub.
Right.
Because they're now realising the damage that's been done to community and social interaction and mental health and general well-being, because they've killed community.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We know it. There are parts of Ireland where the last pub is gone, but there are lots of others that haven't had that fate yet. But the government needs to decide, are they happy about that? Do they want to, are they happy that we end up with no pub except in big urban areas?
Mm. And do you fear that, you know, if there's nothing included now in this upcoming budget, you referenced there that one pub is closed at one a per 2.8 days. Do you fear that will,
yeah,
you know, gradually get, well, not gradually by the sounds of things, but, you know, will worsen quite rapidly?
It will get worse. And even the proposed change, like we were told that the change in the VAT for pubs that sell food would be effective from the 1st of January. And then we were told that maybe it mightn't be effective until the 1st of July of next year. And I'll guarantee you that 6 months is 6 months that there are businesses out there will not survive. They are hanging on for that VAT change on the 1st of January. And like you look at, we're in July and August of the middle of a good summer, a sunny summer, and the middle of a tourist season, and we have pubs closing this week and last week. They're not closing because they're too lazy to work. They're not closing because they're making too much money. They're closing because they can't make ends meet. So with everything that you could say looking like it's right, it's still not right. It's government, in effect, has broken the model, and we need to recreate that model so that the pubs can have a chance to survive.
Yeah,
there will be less, but we do. But there are healthy ones that deserve to survive.
Yeah. Pat Crotty, CEO of the Vintners Federation of Ireland, thank you so much there. And as Pat referenced, you know, some pubs are they're a lifeline for many. It's that social impact, and, you know, they are, especially in rural areas, they are the hub of the community, and a lot of people, you know, pubs have been passed down through generations, and it's a very difficult decision you have to make then to shut the door if they just can't make ends meet. Some comments now. Please wish our son Jason and his wife Rebecca on the birth of their baby girl a little sister for Harris. They live in Cavan, on our way to see the new baby. Thanks. They're thanking me for reading it out. Sorry. Congratulations is the message there. In relation to addiction, I find a far bigger addiction these days are phones. No matter where you go, people are sitting on them. Children are spending hours in their rooms on them. But as much as we complain about children, the biggest offenders are parents. Then they wonder why children have issues. That's a good point about phone addiction, we do automatically assume that it's drug, alcohol or gambling addiction. But yeah, I suppose I have tried myself actually to kind of remove the phone, or, you know, certain times I will put it in one corner of the house and try and say do housework to distract. Then I end up later on, you know, say half an hour, because I haven't scrolled on my phone throughout the day, I end up doom scrolling then, and I suppose that's not ideal late at night either. In relation to high energy bills and families owing as much as €500, there is no one to blame but the government. Instead of tackling the issue of effective pricing fixing by Irish energy providers, they kicked the can down the road with energy credits. The underlying problems are still there, and now they seem to think people can face into winter with unit prices at double what they are. The Palestine families are coming to Ireland because they heard that we had the most expensive children's hospital in the world and therefore the most up-to-date services. Someone should tell them that it's not open yet and may not be for a few more years. Atlantic salmon stocks were devastated. One monofilament net became widely used in the 1980s. The older nylon nets were only effective in the hours of darkness as they are visible in the water. Monofilament nets are invisible in the water, so they are effective 24 hours each day. Plus, they were a fraction of the cost of nylon nets, so fishermen could afford to use 10 times more of it. An immediate adjustment needed to allow fishing hours to fishermen to compensate. This never happened and salmon stocks were decimated. Another listener says, relating to the housing crisis, I'm a single mother to a little one with a life-threatening illness. I struggled during pregnancy to find suitable, affordable accommodation and was unsuccessful. I'm in my late 30s with a child under two and I had to move back in with my parents after she was born as I can't afford these ridiculous prices they're charging a month on top of bills and grocery prices. That's just another example of how the cost of living, the people are struggling with rent and struggling with electricity and energy bills, as well as everyday grocery shopping as well. Now, nearly two-thirds or 64% of Irish SMEs have been unaffected by crime in the past 12 months. ISME has found following a recent public debate about rising crime rates. I'm joined by Neil McDonald, the Chief Executive of ISME. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Michaela.
So I suppose this is positive.
Yes, it is. I suppose it runs counter to some of the narrative that, you know, everyone is plagued by crime. Almost two-thirds of our businesses weren't affected by crime in the last 12 months. But the more concerning piece that comes out of it is that of the one-third that did experience crime, unfortunately, they experienced it. You know, more than two-thirds of those were targeted more than once. So while, you know, crime isn't epidemic across all businesses, unfortunately, the typical victims of it experience crime more than once.
And is there a particular sector that is being targeted more so than the other?
Well, we're an all-sector trade association. We didn't go into that with our members. We, given the nature of what we see, it is evident that a lot of the respondents were in the retail and hospitality mm-hmm. sector, because most of the complaints of crime were around a fifth of complainants complained about antisocial behaviour. 19% of them complained of vandalism, 17% of burglary, and 15% of phishing attacks, various types of phishing attacks on a business. So it would appear, certainly on the antisocial behaviour side, that typically affects retail or customer-facing businesses more than others.
Mm-hmm. But this then has a serious knock-on effect, I suppose, in the cost of running a business.
Of course it does. And aside from the cost imposed by the crime itself, businesses that have been victim of crime report that they have increased security costs afterwards. Their insurance premiums go up, and 17% of them have to make physical alterations to their premises, such as, you know, installing bars on windows or changing locks on doors or fitting new types of windows or so on. So there is a lot of cost imposed on business by crime, and it's not a cost that can just be recovered through insurance alone. And unfortunately, if you do make a claim on your insurance, you know, your insurance will tend to go up afterwards. So crime affects the bottom line of businesses in a big way.
And do business owners feel that they are supported in relation to security measures, or do they feel that there's much more could be done to help them?
Well, interestingly, nearly three quarters of victims of business crime, they rated the Gardaí's performance as adequate or very effective. Mm-hmm. Where the negative commentary comes in is the judicial system and the court system. Okay. And a lot of business owners feel that the system fails to deter repeat offenders, that sentencing is inadequate, or that, you know, the judicial system doesn't take crime against business very seriously. That comes through in this survey.
And I suppose sometimes, you know, there's this perception if you're a business owner, you can afford to, you know, clean up somewhere that's been vandalised. But that's not the case. And you referenced there, you know, insurance is being pushed up then. And it's a serious knock-on effect and, you know, tougher sentencing. And I suppose quickening up the process is needed as well.
Yes. You know, more than three quarters, 76% of businesses want to see tougher sentencing. 85% of businesses want to see more Gardaí. But then aside from that aspect of crime prevention, 73%, nearly three quarters, favour increased CCTV coverage and data sharing. Now, that's a particular issue, Michaela, that a lot of retailers complain of. In other words, their CCTV coverage indicates who the perpetrators are, but they're not allowed to share that data with neighbouring businesses as things stand at the moment. So data sharing is something that a lot of them feel would make a big contribution to crime reduction, but they're not allowed to do it at the moment as the law or guidance on data protection stands.
And is there any element of that data protection law that could be changed to allow this? Or, you know, obviously it's a lengthy process, but is there any indication that something could be done in relation to that?
We certainly feel there is. And you know, GDPR as originally written restricts rights of privacy in the avoidance and prevention of crime. So the regulation as originally written in Brussels does not preclude this. A lot of this comes down to local or national interpretation of laws, which may not necessarily be correct. So, but I can say within the retail forum and elsewhere with Gardaí, we are developing better understandings of what can be shared. And within Northern Ireland, for example, it is common, and Northern Ireland did sign up to GDPR pre-Brexit. There is no difficulty in sharing this kind of data about recidivist criminals visiting one store and then going to another and going to another. It's just a sensible form of risk reduction. So we believe that this is going to happen in the near future. We're hopeful indeed that we could get some progress on it this year.
Yeah, and just looking at some of the figures, you know, 34% of SMEs spend over €5,000 annually on crime prevention. That's a huge cost to businesses. You know, I was speaking there just before chatting to yourself, to a representative from the Vintners Federation of Ireland about the amount of pubs closing. And, you know, this is a huge impact then.
It is, because it's a bottom line cost. It's not a cost that the customer sees as value additive. Yeah. So it's very difficult to pass that cost on to the customer. And in particular, if you've had a big episode, as I said earlier on, with stuff like, say, vandalism or antisocial behaviour, where you have damage inflicted, it may be uninsured damage, or it may be damage that you feel is not worthwhile reporting to your insurer because you're afraid of the impact on your go-forward insurance costs. So that sort of one-off has to be absorbed as a hit to the bottom line of the business. And unfortunately, you know, we are dealing with a lot of businesses, especially outside the major population centres, you know, in Donegal, you're dealing with a lot of businesses that are not highly profitable. Their customer base is very small, and episodes like this go straight to the bottom line and are very, very painful.
Yeah. Neil McDonald, Chief Executive of ISMEI, thank you so much for joining me there. That's interesting. You know, it's positive in one way that nearly two-thirds of Irish SMEs have been unaffected by crime, but it's those that are experiencing crime. 68% were targeted more than once. And as Neil was saying there, you know, they're just being hit by the costs at a time when, you know, businesses, their margins are narrow enough. To a few of your comments now. Hi there. I just want to highlight how dire the housing crisis is in Ireland at the moment. We can see this here in Donegal, but in Dublin, it is absolutely ridiculous. I am part of every accommodation group known to man. I am a primary school teacher on a good wage. I have references available from my employers, previous landlords and my lecturers. All my downtime consists of viewing property rentals. To actually get a property viewing is a miracle. You have to be in Dublin to get time to view a property and you're queuing to even get in. I am so sick of it. Luckily for me, money isn't tight, but I know a lot of people are on a lower wage than me. I've emailed a few properties with queries. One asked if I would cook and that I wouldn't be allowed to cook in the house. I'm paying rent and can't even cook in my own home. Another asked if I would be home much as they need me to be quiet. Working from home isn't allowed. Another property was €620 for a room share along with 9 other people living in the house and €90 worth of bills. I was told to go to college, get a job and you'll be fine. What is the point in working so hard and being honest if a room share in a house with 9 other people is all that Ireland can offer me? Moving back to Donegal and getting a full-time job is the ultimate goal, but obviously I need to get experience under my belt first. I'm just so fed up, this listener says, and that's the case for so many, but having those stipulations, you know, not being allowed to cook in the home, not being allowed to work from home, and €620 for a room share along with 9 other people is, it's just crazy. And, you know, so many people like this listener are out there, they've gone to college, they're trying to, you know, get in their feet, and it's the cost of housing is one thing, but it's the demand as well that is hampering an awful lot of people. Many Arab countries have superb medical facilities. Why aren't Islamic countries taking them? That references the Palestinian children that are in Ireland at the minute. They were due to be moved to Donegal, but the mothers have made calls for them to be moved to within a 2-hour trip of Dublin because they feel that the healthcare here in Donegal isn't adequate. Another listener says, the Gardaí should go down to Fanad and seize all the quads being illegally driven. No point in talking about it. When Garda, Niall Maguire was in earlier on the Garda information slot, he did say that they are being very proactive in relation to the matter. And he did say that, you know, they are wearing helmets and thought maybe, is it a safety issue or is it children, teenagers trying to hide their identity? And then that's difficult then in finding the right house and the door to knock on. RE Gazan children, people criticising these poor children's needs shouldn't be so damn selfish. These kids are primarily suffering from serious shrapnel injuries, major burns and other serious health concerns and complications. Letterkenny does not have the resources needed to deal with these children. And if we want to complain about this lack of resources, then we should be taking to the streets and supporting those who've been campaigning for years for improvement in our hospitals. There's so many issues there at the heart of that story that's in the Irish Times today, and you will have heard Donal referencing it on the news earlier. Is it a resources issue? What is the story? But, you know, the poor mothers and their children, you know, thinking that, well, they feel that they're being forced to Donegal and they don't feel that the healthcare being provided here is up to standard. And, you know, many will argue that, you know, our healthcare is fine. Others will argue that it's not. Once you go to the emergency department, you know, you're sitting on a chair for how long? And there's just such a strain on the hospital and pressure then on staff to meet the needs as well.
Highland Radio weather updates with McElhinney's. Get back to school sorted with all the essentials from school jumpers to shoes. Visit our kidswear department in store or shop online at McElhinney's.com today.
Today's weather, dry and sunny for most. Some isolated showers along with scattered cloud will develop through the afternoon. Very warm with highest temperatures of 22 to 26 degrees in a light easterly breeze. And we were speaking to Kenneth from the Donegal Weather Channel earlier, and he thinks that there is a possibility that it could continue into next week as well. So no doubt everyone will be hoping and praying for that. Now, Ireland's deposit return scheme is boosting recycling, but wheelchair users say they're being left behind. Pamela Kavanagh is head of communications with the Irish Wheelchair Association. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning.
So what kind of issues are wheelchair users facing in relation to the deposit return scheme?
Well, I suppose, simply put, people with disabilities, you know, weren't consulted in any way from the start in relation to the deposit return scheme. And it's just to say IWA in general is very supportive of the government and Ireland's sustainability goals. However, the machines are simply too high. They're not accessible for wheelchair users. You may know yourself if you just think about how you even stand in front of the machines, if you're able to stand. It's quite high, so yeah. For a wheelchair user, it's just near on impossible, to reach.
And were you given an opportunity before this was rolled out to make any representations regarding the machines?
No, we weren't. We weren't consulted in any way. And as far as we can tell, we don't know of any other representative group within the disability community that was consulted. So it is pretty shocking that something like this got through. All the loopholes that it would have had to go through in this day and age in order to be put out there. When it was launched, like, one in five people in Ireland has a disability. It's 22% of the population. It's a big representative community. So it's just the lack of consultation is just shocking. Ireland has signed up to the United Nations protocol around disability, and, you know, for it just not to be involved in this case as well is just pretty shocking at this stage, yeah.
And it's a cost as well to wheelchair users. You know, they're missing out on the return of these deposits.
Yeah, exactly. Well, recently Return issued figures saying that 66.7 million euros worth of bottles and cans have not been returned. So they're saying that this kind of money is out there in the ether. But people with disabilities, particularly mobility issues and a physical disability and wheelchair users, are being prevented from taking up the opportunity to bring back their return cans and bottles. Now, obviously, some are, you know, either asking for help.
Yeah.
But again, it's just Irish Wheelchair Association. I mean, we really work with our members and obviously advocate for independent living. And it's just another thing that people have to ask for help for, which they don't want to do.
Yeah.
So it is hampering people's independence. And just for a reminder, we actually launched an awareness campaign in April around various access issues in communities all across Ireland, including Donegal. And one of the videos that was shared was from one of our members in Mayo. And I just reshared it on Irish Wheelchair Association's Instagram account this morning prior to this conversation, just to show and demonstrate people how inaccessible the machines are. And that video got like over 20,000 views. So it's a really hot topic for our members, and for people with disabilities. So if people are unsure about what we're talking about, just have a quick look at our Instagram. You'll see that the issue is, it's very black and white. It's very plain to see. And look, throughout that campaign, we have been calling that on the government to appoint an access officer in each area so that they can look at not only issues with the return machines, but access barriers that people with disabilities face.
But it's even travelling to those machines. You know, not everywhere has a machine.
Yeah, well, look, that's it. And I'm sure if you look at around Donegal as well, the travelling to the machines, even with your bags of cans and bottles, can be a challenge, especially if you're trying to push a wheelchair, if you're in a manual wheelchair, or if you're in a powered chair, then obviously your hands have to do other jobs. Transport is a big issue for people with disabilities, so not everybody has their own accessible vehicle. There are really high costs involved in mobility and driving for people with disabilities. So yeah, like, even should they be successful to get in front of a machine, they have overcome a couple of barriers before they get already there, it's safe to say.
And do wheelchair users feel that they have been discriminated against in this? Or just left out of the picture altogether?
Yeah, exactly. Look, we are consistently calling for consultation for people with the lived experience. We don't expect organisations and government to get it right all the time. But if they just consulted with those with the lived experience at an early stage, when designing, so things should be of universal design, I suppose. It's a bit jargony, but basically put, like, we're all getting older as well. We may come into a mobility issue later in life. So our membership represents people that are not only born with a physical disability, but some people acquire them. So it makes sense that we're not retrofitting things in society in general. So, yeah, if there was proper consultation at an early stage, stop designing systems, you know, and then asking questions later on, basically, because it's costly for the government as well.
And Pamela, what specific changes would you like the government to do now? Do you think that there could be some kind of scheme in place, or we just need a complete review of the machines themselves?
Yeah, well, look, in relation to the return machines themselves, there's better minds in government, I'm sure, that will come up with better solutions than I would have. But what I will be saying is that meaningful consultation with disability groups, with people with physical disabilities, is critical, and it's something we have to just bring into everyday life. So not only in relation to the return machines, but also when we're designing bus stops and footpaths, and accessibility in our communities is essential so that people can live independently. And that has a positive knock-on effect on so much. And full-time, fully resourced access officers in every county council. Ideally, a person with the lived experience, again, would be a massive progressive step for Ireland, so that, again, issues like this can be identified before they come out and potentially cost a lot of money to try and retrofit and make accessible.
Yeah, absolutely, because it is a great idea and it is working well. But that 66.7 million euro that you referenced there earlier, that's a huge amount of money that's out there. And, you know, we don't know exactly how much of that relates to wheelchair users who can't access this. And, you know, it just makes sense to have a consultation beforehand.
Yeah, look, that's it, and that's all we're asking for. And as I said, yes, we're very supportive of, like, sustainability goals, and it's fantastic to see people recycling. It is great that, you know, it has been embraced so much, and all we're asking for is that same opportunity afforded to people with disabilities as everybody else. We want to recycle and get back our 15 cent as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Pamela, thank you so much for joining me this morning. That's Pamela Kavanagh, Head of Communications with the Irish Wheelchair Association. That's it for this morning's 9 till noon show. We'll be back tomorrow morning from 9. Thanks so much to Carling Orr and to Shannon Wilkin for all their help on the show. John Breslin is up next on Around the Northwest. A very good morning. The Mother's